I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if I may. This is a bit unusual of a case of how it came about to be prosecuted. The facts that came out of trial were that Cherise Gertz and her two twin children, Juliet and Galen, were living at a house with her boyfriend, Mr. Chauncey, and Mr. Townsend. The two twin girls had their own bedroom. Cherise and Mr. Chauncey had their bedroom. Mr. Townsend slept on the couch, basically. On July 10th, the group goes to the Rodeo Days, which is kind of a festival carnival. They leave there, come home, have friends over, they drink into the night. Everybody leaves around 2 o'clock. Juliet has a seizure. They take her to the hospital. She's checked out and it's fine. They come back home. Mr. Callens is passed out on the couch. They put Juliet to bed. They go to their room and have sexual intercourse. In the morning, Mr. Townsend comes in with Juliet. She's deceased. Hands her to Mr. Chauncey. He puts on some pants because he has no clothes on. Takes the child to the living room. Mr. Townsend runs across to the neighbor. They call 911. The police arrive and Juliet is deceased. After an autopsy, it was determined she died of blunt force trauma to the head and to the abdomen. After some time, the prosecuting attorney and the county attorney had not filed charges. The case was referred to the Attorney General's office, I think specifically Doug Warner. Charges were not filed. An aunt of the deceased child then gets a petition drive to see the grand jury. They receive enough signatures, grand jury is seated. At that time, Doug Warner is the county attorney for Scotts Bluff.
He wasn't during the initial period.
I believe it was Mr. Weimer, who I believe left because he became a judge. Mr. Warner is the county attorney, but the district court appoints a special prosecutor to handle the grand jury proceedings. There appeared to be no conflict with Mr. Warner handling it. It's his duty as a county attorney to do that. This was not an investigation of a county official or a special prosecutor would then be appointed.
But well, a special conflict prosecutor was appointed. Is an issue here, right? Whether or not there was or wasn't a conflict. What did the trial judge say with respect to the propriety of appointing a special prosecutor?
Well, the trial judge said, and this is based on an affidavit from Mr. Warner, basically said, I didn't think there was a conflict, but there seemed to be an appearance of impropriety because we wanted fresh eyes to look at it. The district court judge said there was a conflict of interest based on the fact that the aunt was dissatisfied with the county attorney, Mr. Warner, at the time because he wouldn't file charges. Doesn't appear to be a conflict such as
Is this right? This is one of your assignments of error. Appointing the special prosecutor was error.
Correct.
Right? So what's our standard of review with respect to that ruling that it was okay?
I believe it's abuse of discretion is the standard for that. There's not a lot of case law on that, but from my memory, that's what I recall of it.
Counsel, if this court accepts your principle as you've outlined in your brief, how would citizens ever have a remedy on their own if they disagree with the conduct of any county attorney in the state of Nebraska?
Well, their remedy is the remedy that they pursued. Get a petition, the seated grand jury, the county attorney's not filing the charges, the grand jury is seated. Just because they're dissatisfied with the county attorney not filing the charges, shouldn't result in the county attorney then being excluded unless there's some actual conflict. Otherwise, it appears that the petitioners can get a petition, skirt the elected county attorney to get a special prosecutor to prosecute their case.
Did your client suffer some special injustice because of this?
Well, and this goes to some of my other errors. I think there is some prejudice to Mr. Chauncey based on the way the grand jury was conducted by the special prosecutor. As I sign in my assignment as errors, he instructs the grand jury to look at the law as it is in 2008.
Well,
and then go look at the
let me stop you here. Let's hypothetically assume that everything went perfectly in the grand jury, then does your client have any special prejudice?
If everything in the grand jury went perfectly, the law was instructed correctly, the grand jury handed down an indictment, just as if they would have with the county attorney, it's hard to say what the prejudice is, but it certainly appears to be, it gives the appearance of somebody getting railroaded by not being prosecuted by the duly elected authority. I guess the prejudice is not only to my client, but to the, I guess, the judicial system as a whole, that we can't just have people coming in saying, I don't like this elected prosecutor, I'm going to complain about him so I can get a special prosecutor appointed. It gives anybody that wants to do a petition, then they can just complain about the prosecutor and they can skirt the elected official.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get the relief, does it?
No, that's true.
The trial court made a finding that there was a conflict of interest. Isn't that the basis upon which we would look at the validity of the appointment of the special prosecutor?
The trial court said that this really was, there was a conflict of interest, but it's curious to note that Mr. Warner in his affidavit said this is not a conflict of interest. The county attorney didn't think there was a conflict of interest, other than the person getting the petition was displeased with him. I think it creates a situation where if we just have...
What, are you saying that if Warner had been the county attorney, he never would have been convicted?
I'm saying if Warner... Mr. Warner obviously didn't feel that there was enough evidence to charge somebody. And we allow petitioners to get a petition and then skirt the local county attorney and bring in special prosecutors. It has the appearance of people getting railroaded or mob rule, something like that. I can't say, I mean, would things have been different if Mr. Warner had done the grand jury? I don't know. I have some arguments about the prosecutor that did do the grand jury was not very effective, not very efficient by instructing improperly.
Did the family ask for a special prosecutor? Or did they just petition for the grand jury?
They petitioned for the grand jury. When the grand jury was determined they have enough signatures, a district court in Scotts Bluff just appointed a special prosecutor without anybody requesting it.
So the family didn't make the request to create a railroading situation. They just asked for the prosecution or the grand jury to be convened to determine if prosecution should occur. Is that correct?
That's correct, and there's no evidence in the record that there was any conversation between the petitioners and the district court judge or anything of that, other than there was known in the community, this is, I think, in the record, that the petitioners were dissatisfied with the county attorney's office, the way they had not filed any charges.
And that's evidenced by the petition to ask the grand jury.
It's evidenced by the petition, and it's also in Mr. Warner's affidavit, I believe, that he submitted at the hearing, that they were displeased with him for not prosecuting this case.
Did Mr. Warner object to the appointment of a special prosecutor?
As far as I know, he did not. There was a special prosecutor appointed, handled the grand jury. Once the indictment was found and it was filed in the district court, Mr. Warner then filed a motion to have that special prosecutor come in as a special deputy to help handle the case. And then Mr. Warner also worked on the case as well. It's hard to say there was a conflict with Mr. Warner, that's why a special prosecutor was appointed, when Mr. Warner was actually trying the case himself as well. Obviously, as I signed in my brief, one of the errors that I think occurred at the grand jury is the improper instruction of the law by the special prosecutor to the grand jury. Not only giving them an explanation of reckless, that was essentially telling them what intentional things were, calling them reckless, but also pointing to them that when they looked at the law at 2008, they then would have to go and look at the 2012 supplement to see if there are any changes in the law. This was a charge that happened in 2008. The law that handled the case or should rule the case is 2008 law. By bringing in that supplement and telling the jury you've got to go look at the supplement for changes of law, and there were changes of law from 2008 to 2012, he's misleading the jury, instructing the jury incorrectly. And I think I lay out the hypothetical in my brief. You could have had half of the grand jury looking at the 2008 law, half looking at the 2012 law, and saying, hey, this section, I think 707-6, we want to indict on this, that they were different from those different time periods.
The indictment or the information itself cites the 08 law.
It does cite the 08 law, but we have to assume, I think, that the grand jury is following the instructions of the special prosecutor to go look at the 2012 law. So we're not sure which law they wanted to indict on, although the indictment says the 2008 law. That was written by the special prosecutor, but he told them to go look at both ones. So if they came and told him, hey, we want to indict under this section, we don't know if they all thought it was the 2008 section they wanted to indict on or the 2012 section. Obviously, that would have been different because the 2012 law for Section 707-6 was negligent child abuse in a Class 3 felony versus intentional child abuse, a Class 1B felony.
Was indictment by the grand jury a prerequisite to filing criminal charges against the defendant?
I'm sorry?
Was the indictment by the grand jury a prerequisite to filing criminal charges against the defendant?
No, the county attorney could have filed them on his own.
So what difference does it make? He filed the charges, and if the grand jury didn't indict, does that prohibit the prosecutor from filing charges?
It would have prevented the prosecutor from filing charges, but that's not what happened in this case.
Right.
It was the indictment that was the start of the criminal proceeding. Even if the grand jury said we're not going to indict the prosecutor, still
he didn't really need a grand jury to file the charges, did he?
Did not, no.
Was there a preliminary hearing?
There was not. The indictment was handed down, filed in district court, and proceedings went from there. Now, obviously, we filed a motion to dismiss based on there not being probable cause to support the indictment under the statute. The district court reviewed the testimony of Brandon Townsend and stipulated that's sufficient to show there's probable cause. I argue it's not sufficient to show probable cause. And the reason for that is Mr. Townsend is basically speculating on what happens. He says, I'm asleep the entire time from when they leave until the morning I wake up. He's making statements in the grand jury testimony like, I felt what happened was, or I feel what Chauncey did. One of the grand juries asked him specifically, is this just you speculating about what happened? And he said, yes, this is me speculating. Speculation is not enough to support probable cause.
Was that the only thing submitted to the judge to determine probable cause?
The only thing submitted to the judge was a stipulation that the death was not an accident, that it was a homicide, and the transcript of Brandon Townsend's testimony. We were getting a transcript of the entire grand jury proceeding, but the prosecution said what Brandon Townsend said was enough, so that's all that was submitted to the judge to make that determination.
Counsel, one of three people had to have harmed this child, correct?
That seems to be what the evidence is. There's three people in the house, there's nobody else, there's no break-ins or anything.
So isn't that in of itself probable cause that one of those three people committed the crime? Wouldn't a reasonable person believe one of those three did it?
One of the three, but does that mean that Dustin Chauncey should be one that's being tried? I think the question is, this child was killed. It wasn't an accident. One of those three did it, we can assume, but there's no evidence of which one did it.
Wouldn't that be a factual issue for the trier of fact to determine whether this was the appropriate person to be charged?
At trial, it would be for the trier of fact, obviously. My argument is that at that stage, when we asked for the judge to dismiss it based on not probable cause, at that time, what the district court judge had in front of him, that testimony of Brandon Townsend, was insufficient to show probable cause that Dustin Chauncey was the one that caused it.
Wasn't there evidence that indicated that the defendant had, in fact, had contact with the victim around the same time that he was having intercourse with his wife or girlfriend?
There was evidence at trial that came out later at trial. This was based on the testimony of Paul Cardwell, who I would describe as a professional snitch. He had testified in numerous trials and given information in other cases. He said that Mr. Chauncey told him in the jail that the girl had come in and interrupted them during sex.
Well, yeah, okay, but there was forensic evidence also, wasn't there?
There was evidence that there was sperm fraction DNA on the girl's shirt, and that's one of the issues I attacked, but the expert said there's no way to tell when that was put on there. It could have been put on there a month before, a week before, a day before. So that is not, I think, smoking gun evidence, particularly in a household where there are dirt clothes everywhere.
Moving forward, does the issue of probable cause before the grand jury become moot after a trial and a conviction?
That is what the state is arguing, obviously.
And what do you think the law is?
Well, it's unclear because I couldn't find any case law in Nebraska that says, as the state proposes, the judge's determination of probable cause is the equivalent of a judge's determination in a plea and abatement. I couldn't find any law in Nebraska to that effect. It seems to me that on a preliminary hearing, you have a judge making a determination of probable cause in the county court. It goes to the district court. The district court acts as an appellate review of the county court's judgment.
But what is the law? What is the law generally elsewhere with respect to this kind of issue?
I couldn't tell you for it. I have not researched that.
Well, it's not a challenge. You framed it as something went wrong with the grand jury, right? But it's not a challenge, say, to the composition of the grand jury.
No.
Customarily preserved, arguably.
Right.
Okay. So this is just a question of quantum of proof.
Exactly.
Okay.
And why
doesn't that become moot after a conviction before a jury?
The evidence at the grand jury did not include all the evidence that was then presented at trial that was arguably the state's evidence, the DNA evidence, the snitch testimony. Mr. Chauncey would have had it on a trial if the court had dismissed it based on not having called the cause. The state says it's the equivalent of a plea and abatement. It seems to me that in a plea and abatement, there are two judges that have looked at the evidence and found it to be okay to proceed. With the grand jury, there's only been one judge to do that. And my belief is that this court can act as that second panel, essentially, to look at the evidence and overturn the district court judge's decision.
Why is not the jury that second piece of eyes?
The jury, well, in this case, I would argue that there are problems with the jury because they were given testimony that was not relevant, was prejudicial, that they shouldn't have seen. If they hadn't seen that evidence, which they wouldn't have had gone to trial, actually, but if they hadn't seen that evidence, they wouldn't have given it. That evidence was not presented at the grand jury. My argument is that there should have been a second review of that. It should result in dismissal, so it should never have gone to the jury.
No, but you acknowledge the quantum of proof before the grand jury is less than at the trial.
Yes.
For the jury, right? Is enough to keep going. I don't mean to make light of it.
The grand jury needs to find probable cause to make an indictment. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you.
Do you think there's any difference between that probable cause standard and the probable cause standard at a preliminary hearing following the filing of a complaint in county court?
I don't think there is any difference. I mean, there's a lot of definitions of probable cause and what you should use. Is it probable cause, as it's defined in, say, a suppression stop, may be different than probable cause in a preliminary hearing, but it seems to me it's the same.
Okay.
There's not an exact wording definition that's the same everywhere, but I think it's the same for those. And the grand jury and the preliminary hearing stage.
Okay, good.
One of the issues I obviously address is the DNA and the state being allowed to bring in the evidence, the sperm on the shirt. Our argument is not relevant, and it's prejudicial, and the state brought all this stuff in when they were told not to do that unless they first had the judge hear from an expert that could determine timing of if there could be a termination of the timing. That was the issue for the state. That it had to have been placed on that shirt after they got back and had intercourse and before Townsend found the girl. The evidence wasn't that. There was no evidence that could be true. The expert testified It could be placed on there months in advance, days. It doesn't have to be wet to transfer. And that's what the state was arguing. It had to be wet to transfer. That's not what the expert said. But the state ran all that stuff through anyways, doing it in disregard of the order from the motion in limine saying, tell me and tell the defense before you bring this stuff in. So the first thing they do in opening statement is bring in the sperm on the clothes. There's an objection, motion for mistrial, and then they bring it again with Mr. Cardwell before the expert can testify about that. And obviously we think that's a prejudicial error. It was irrelevant. They brought up the idea that this is a sexual assault. It seems I'm out of time, so I'd ask the court to reverse and remand based on my issues that I've heard.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Faust, assistant attorney general representing Napoli, the state of Nebraska. The majority of Chauncey's assigned errors deal with the grand jury proceedings and not his actual trial. And the state's overall position is that Chauncey had a fair trial where the state proved his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And that fair trial and that guilty verdict cured any defects that occurred during the grand jury proceeding. In more detail, the state's position is that the district court properly denied Townsend's motion to dismiss the indictment because Townsend's testimony provided probable cause that Chauncey did commit intentional child abuse that resulted in Juliet's death. Only one of three people could have caused Juliet's death. It was Townsend, Chauncey, or Juliet's mother, Charisse. Townsend testified he was asleep the entire time, and Chauncey does not dispute that fact. Based upon Townsend's personal knowledge of Charisse and Chauncey and of the circumstances surrounding Juliet's death, Townsend believed that Chauncey was the one who caused her death. He testified that Chauncey was the one who was really panicked before law enforcement arrived and asked him and Townsend to lie about his name. The grand jury very well could have inferred that that was Chauncey's consciousness of guilt, not his belief that he told the other two that he had warrants out for his arrest, and that's why he was asking them to lie. On the other hand, you have Charisse, who's completely distraught that her daughter's not waking up and dead. Townsend described Chauncey as the violent one in the household. Chauncey was the one joking with Charisse shortly after Juliet's death about getting money from the hospital and passing a lie detector test. And Townsend did tell the grand jury that he knew that Chauncey's sperm was found on Juliet. But frankly, as I said before, even if insufficient, it was cured by the trial, where his guilt was proved beyond a reasonable doubt. The state submits it is no different than a ruling on a plea and abatement that challenges the sufficiency of the evidence after a preliminary hearing. There is no meaningful distinction between the two. The goals of the two are the same. It's whether or not the defendant, there's probable cause to believe the defendant committed the offense. The filed indictments and the filed informations are the functional equivalent of each other. The prosecution can do either or. The defendant's recourse then is either a motion to dismiss the indictment or a plea and abatement if he or she believes that the evidence was insufficient. Moving on to the motion to quash.
Let me back up just a little bit. Have we written much about grand juries?
No. No, you've not.
And so I was asking Ms. Lancaster the same thing. What is the law in this area generally with respect to errors, arguable errors at the grand jury?
Well, in general, the federal courts don't even allow insight into this. They don't even allow ones to go into the sufficiency of the evidence of the grand jury. But states that have looked to other federal court decisions, mainly U.S. versus Mechnick, are errors or defects before the grand jury are rendered harmless by a guilty verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. Only if they arise to such, I think, racial and gender discrimination.
I was suggesting with respect to constitutional error, for example, in the composition of a grand jury, that will not be cured by trial, arguably?
Yes, that is the only time that I believe that they will actually vacate the conviction after trial.
If a special prosecutor was appointed clearly without authority and over the objection of a county attorney, could a grand jury proceeding prosecuted by that special prosecutor be the foundation of a valid criminal conviction?
Yes. I think that is going, it's not going to rise to the composition level. It's not, if the grand jury goes ahead and indicts, no matter who presented the evidence to it.
So if a citizen walks in off the street and persuades a grand jury to indict?
I don't think a citizen could be designated a special prosecutor.
Well, let's take the hypothetical to the next level. Someone who has literally no appointment at all walks in and, for whatever reason, is permitted to speak to the grand jury. They like him. Can that be the foundation of a criminal conviction?
My answer is going to be yes. If he goes to trial and his guilt is proved beyond a reasonable doubt, it's going to cure those defects that occur during the grand jury.
What happened to the prerogatives of the executive branch in that situation?
Got to answer your question. I just know that the purpose of reversing and giving a defendant a new trial is the basis that he did not get a fair trial. And where he receives one, that conviction should stay.
Suppose someone files a complaint, it's not the county attorney, or perhaps a county attorney who didn't file the bond. It's not a validly de jure county attorney. Is that conviction valid?
I understand where you're going now, and I suppose in instances where there is no authority for the prosecutor to even proceed in the first place.
So does the issue about whether the special county attorney is validly appointed have a potential impact at the end of the case?
It could in such extreme circumstances as you are suggesting. Here we don't have that circumstance. We have an attorney who was appointed to be a special prosecutor. I argue there was a conflict of interest. I think the appearance of impropriety certainly can be a conflict of interest.
Well, the issue is always going to be litigated at some point, isn't it? Because generally the defendant would file a plea and abatement with regard to the indictment, and that would preserve that for review on appeal. So we're always going to talk about it on appeal.
Or you get that the defendant is vindicated because he gets that district court review. But in most circumstances, in most jurisdictions, it is certainly held that trial, it cures it. Because the defendant's right to a fundamentally fair trial has been vindicated.
So the argument should be, now having had a trial, the argument should be with regard to whether there was error at trial that would require a reversal, and not necessarily error in the grand jury who made the indictment.
Yes, but for the composition of the grand jury, which is how the jurisdictions decide. As for the penalty sections and how the special prosecutor advised the jury, the indictment on its face contradicts his argument. The actual language of the indictment says knowingly and intentional. It does not mention negligence. So he was indicted based upon the 2008 law, clearly, just by the face of the indictment, the language of it itself. With regards to the motion in limine, the district court properly denied it. Paul Caldwell's testimony came to light after the indictment was issued. It changed the whole timing issue. We no longer needed a DNA expert, Mr. Linder, to come in and set the foundation for the timing and of transfer of semen, whether it needs to be wet or dry, because now you have Paul Caldwell's testimony telling you exactly when it transferred, because Chauncey told him when it transferred. There is no prejudice under 403 because this case was so clearly not about a sexual assault. It's not how the state argued it. In fact, after the opening statements, when the prosecutor mentioned it, the jury was told to disregard the statement. And then the state even went further and offered to stipulate and tell the jury there was nothing sexual that occurred in this case. And the defense counsel refused to stipulate. Finally, the district court properly denied Chauncey's motion to commence trial. Chauncey must show actual prejudice, and he cannot because the sperm DNA evidence was properly admitted after Cardwell's testimony, and the district court instructed the jury, like I said, to disregard the prosecutor's opening statement.
What was the order then of proof? There was expert testimony in the case. But it was after the mentions of DNA. Is that right?
Well, it was after Paul Cardwell's testimony where he testified, what did Chauncey tell you about the sperm? Or was there sperm mentioned when Chauncey was telling you what happened? And so now Paul Cardwell is the foundation for exactly why are we even talking about this evidence. And once that comes out and the district court says, yes, this is coming in now, then Robert Linder...
On the basis of identity?
On the basis of identity, it corroborates this now what Chauncey told Cardwell, and the sperm DNA evidence corroborate each other now. So after Paul Cardwell's...
Not so much identity as it is timing.
Well, it's timing that also is highly probative of who the perpetrator was.
Well,
because
of course it would prove who left the sample on the child's sleeping wear, but the important thing would be when was that left?
Right, because you
DNA will establish who's the donor.
Yeah, and that can
it's simply a matter of timing as to when it was deposited on the shirt.
But I think it's also very highly probative of who the perpetrator was because Cardwell that he did it. And when after he did it, he carried her to her room naked, and that's when his sperm got on her. So it's...
This corroborated the story.
Exactly. There are no further questions? We ask you from the judgment district.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then to the next case of the day, which is Devney versus Devney.